So, before I introduce our final author for the evening, I want to say that a lot of the impetus for this event was specifically because we knew that we had a big release coming out. It was a novel that came out 20 years ago, 1994, was a major mass market release at the time, won a number of awards, and established an infamous career. and we're honored to be able to bring it back into print in paperback form once again, the 20th anniversary edition of Dr. Michael Arnzen's Grave Markings. And again, as I mentioned, Nathan put together the cover. We have the artist in the back who did the cover art and also the work on the back, I believe.
No.
Okay. Never mind that part. I guess the book is now officially out.
Mm-hmm.
And we have copies here for the first time at an event. And I failed to mention before, we can take credit cards if you are interested. So, Mike Arnzen is another abnormal case. We have a lot of abnormal cases. we've known Mike since the very beginning, back before we had a publishing company, and we were just editors of a literary journal. And he was gracious enough to talk to us, even though we were just starting out, and he's been very influential the development of our company, but also the development of the independent horror scene as well. He's one of the first to really embrace flash fiction and get out there on the internet. So without further ado, I think Mike is going to talk about his novel Grave Markings and maybe do a little flash fiction for us tonight.
Nah. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, John. I was told I would have the indulgence of a little bit more time than some of the other speakers, but I'll try not to put you to sleep. Here's my plan. First, I want to just share my gratitude, talk a little bit about the novel Grave Markings, which I'm going to read an excerpt from with you this evening. But I want to start by reading maybe some flash fiction and poetry, some really short, weird, bizarro horror, because I don't feel like we're bizarro enough yet. So the time has come.
No, I'm just kidding.
And then at the end, if you're not asleep, maybe we can do a Gregorian chant together. If you're into it. If you're asleep, we'll all just cluster around you and do a Gregorian chant. Okay. First, a little show and tell and an expression of gratitude. Because I want to, you know, this book, Grave Markings, came out 20 years ago. It's rare to have this happen, where a book is reprinted and still alive, or in this case, resurrected from the dead. So I really just wanted to thank the publishers of Raw Dog Screaming Fresh for supporting my work for a long time. Not 20 years, but now you might as well have. And I really appreciate it. Here's to 20 more. Raw Dog Screaming Press just celebrated its 10th anniversary last year, so you're gaining on me. And I just want to do a quick show and tell to show you the historical record of Grave Markings. This is what it looked like when it was published as a mass market paperback from Delibes Books 20 years ago. I'm going to pass this around. You're allowed to laugh at my mullet in the author photo. Ten years after that came out and had won the Bram Stoker Award, the International Horror Critics Guild Award, and whatever else, Delirium Books kindly put it out in a limited edition hardcover for the 10th anniversary 10 years ago. And they also published a leather-bound one, which was really cool because this book is about tattooing, so to have it bound in skin is totally awesome. So you take a look at that, no mullets involved. And then this is where I cheekily thought I would be bizarro. I actually, in the spirit of Edgar Allan Poe, just brought along with me a heart that actually beats, I think. and I was just going to pass it around.
So you can feel the throbbing heart.
Though it's going to make a distracting noise, but that's all right. It feels pretty sick, doesn't it? Bizarro. Again, I just wanted to express my gratitude to everybody, and also thanks to the artists involved with this book, because the book really is about art and horror and the weirdness of creativity. I wish I could get a photo of that. Just keep it out of your underwear, please. but if you didn't already meet them, Nate Rosen, who just read to you, helped design the front cover of that book, put in the colorization, did things like that. Ethan Brewer is on the couch back there, he just held the heart. He is the tattoo artist who did the skull on the cover. So that's totally awesome. I just wanted to thank both of you guys for doing it. Are you in the mood yet? Well, while that's going around, I thought I would share just a couple of things with you. And one is really just filler because I can't stand the sound of that heartbeat anymore. This is something I posted to my website, gorlitz.com, where I run a newsletter called Gore Letter. Also, Bram Stoker Award. It was called Arnzen's Halloween Fantasies, and I thought I would read a couple of those to you to get you in the mood for Bizarro Halloween. So one of them is, there's a series of these. I'll sing it later. Here's one of them. When the late night teens come trouncing to my door, I'll say, finally, as I open it in a huff. When the kids reach into my large candy bowl and pull out the fistful of maggots that were squirming inside the Snickers bar wrappers, I'll shrug and say, it's not my fault, I've been waiting for you to come all year. Now make sure you take it all this time. It's like a rim shot. How about this one? I have planned the very best parlor games for my Halloween party. We will go bobbing for Adam's apples and play pin the tail on the kids sewn up in the donkey costume. I'll just end with this one. There's like 30 of them here, though. I have a lot of sick fantasies about Halloween. When I answer the door and the kids sing, trick or treat, smell my feet, give me something to good to eat, I will obey. I will drop right down on my knees, inhaling the odor of their dirty little feet with the wanton abandon of the pump fetishist, crying, eat me, master, eat me. It's a work of fiction. I can't vouch for the quality of what I'm about to read to you, but because I'm going to read to you an excerpt that's 20 years old, and I remember, standing on a stage like this reading it 20 years ago, I thought I would just print out and read to you what's on my computer right now. The last thing I wrote. Definitely just to make me feel young. But I don't know if it's any good or not. I basically sat down looking at a piece of art that's, if you subscribe to Gorlo, you may have seen this. It's a picture of a brain. And I said, all right, brain, I'm going to write a poem about brain tumor. And I wrote three things here. I'm just going to share them with you. So these are my tumor poems. First one, of course, is a limerick. Fate has a cruel sense of humor. It hides in your head like a tumor. And for quite some time, it may stay quite benign, and its purpose is only a rumor. Yet when fortune is made and your bills are all paid, your fate will become your consumer. You laughed at everything except the limerick. I think I don't know how to write, and that's the secret of my thing. This one is more of a think piece. It doesn't have a title. There are tumors that are chained together like paper dolls, holding malignant hands of tissue across the brain. These are the tumors with a capital T, literally two more than the devil meant to reproduce. And then this last bit, it's called Anatomy of the Brain. The word lobe was applied to brain matter in the 1670s. Prior to that, in its original Greek, lobos meant vegetable pods, i.e. we are all pod people. Four lobes. The occipital lobe is named for its placement, resting against and behind the remainder of the matter, like some cowering weakling crushed beneath the dogpile of brains. Occipital, occupied with its social position, and therefore pitiful in every way. Paranoid, the occipital lobe madly processes sight, wishing for more than two front-facing eyeballs to feed it, wishing it were instead one giant pupil absorbing all. The temporal lobe is always late to meetings and can't hold a job. These are the cells you kill without a second thought because they're where memory is stored. The parietal lobe is the laboratory of the senses, but it just stands there in the middle of everything, a wallflower of goop, breathing it all in. The other lobes wish it would just get out of the way. The frontal lobe, of course, steals the show. It's jeery, annoyingly plump with ideas, and always obnoxiously full-on nude. It's always jutting forward as if ready to pour out over the bearer's brow. If it could just turn around, it might see that the others are nudging it forward. Thank you. Applause, eh? All right, I'll give you it. This is the opening bit to Grave Markings. It has a little something to do with brain. It's kind of like, you know, a preface to a book. It just jumps right in. But I think you'll see it's apropos to our location tonight, among other things. You're going to meet a tattoo artist named Mark Michael Kilpatrick, who is basically, at this point, at the very beginning of the story, going mad. And so I tried to basically hook, I guess, a reader into his madness right from the beginning to make it something you can possibly feel or imagine in a weird way, rather than just depicting him killing people, which is what the rest of the book does. Thanks. That's the good stuff. No one fucking understands art anymore. The thought wavered, each syllable taking liquid form and substance, a volcanic pulsing anger of language that seethed and writhed and boiled inside his skull until the brittle bones shattered as his cranium exploded. His mind began to ooze out and trail down his flesh, etching pain down his arms, his legs, pooling at his feet, filling the room till he was drowning, suffocating on his own thoughts and feelings, all lava in his lungs. He manically tried to swim out, but the floor held him down as the liquid bubbled and hardened, melting him into it. He was it, and it was him, and he, it, was what? Mark Michael Kilpatrick thought he was dead. A blinding flash of light filled his eyes, stars in the sockets, fire in his brain, no breathing room, no blood. And as fast as it started, it ended like the momentary darkness in a blink of the eyes. Kilpatrick was standing inside of his head, which had been turned inside out to accompany him. His skull had expanded to fill the entire room, wallpapering its walls with creviced ivory bone. The wormy curls of his yellow brain had engulfed his entire body, becoming a maze of gray matter that he could step through, dark thresholds of ideas and experiences he could visit and toy with, change and transfer. He looked down at his body, completely naked and hairless, but the tattoos he had gathered over the years remained inked deeply and darkly into his skin. A large rod of pink flesh trailed down from where his belly button should have been. A hard, bony umbilicus that scraped the floor beneath him like a bumper car electrode.
It was electric. All of it. Electric and alive. A carnival of his mind. And it was hot. He took a step forward and the wet muck beneath his feet spattered like stove grease. The heat felt good. Joyously, Kilpatrick dove into the air, twisting like a gymnast and landing on his back. He let the hilly maze of his brain transport him through his life experiences, his past life, hazy memories come alive, remembrances from womb to school to work. Most of the memories were the same, Kilpatrick in his garage, his makeshift tattoo shop, inking the skin of indifferent clients for a pittance that hardly paid the bills. But it wasn't the money that mattered. Money was dead paper, worthless. The tattoo, the living, breathing art embedded in human skin, was the only thing that drove him. He poured his heart into hundreds of skins, creating masterpieces that would make Rembrandt jealous. Even if someone wanted a plain old skull tattooed on their arm, Kilpatrick had a million ways of looking at a skull, and each was a genuine original vision, a glimpse of the world as he saw it, that deserved to be carried around on the flesh, to share and enlighten the ignorant. Watching his creation of tattoos long gone, Kilpatrick became enthralled. So much he had learned since the early days, so much innate talent stitched into the pores of his clients. But something else, something more elusive about these memories, some constant recurrent theme underpinning each tattoo. And then he realized what it was, indifference. None of the people whose flesh he had graced with his talent were pure art lovers. None appreciated his work. There were men who got a tattoo to get chicks, or to look tough, or to join a gang, but none really cared about the essence of the art piece. There were women who got tattooed for the same reason, but none understood the true nuances of Kilpatrick's creations, and none really cared. No one cared. Anger returned, and Kilpatrick wanted this visit of his life to be over and done with. Hell, he wanted his whole life to be done with. Visiting his past made him realize that it had all been a worthless farce. Catering to the petty needs of others. The payback had once been the creation itself, but that was no longer enough. He forced himself to the end of this trial. Visions rushed past his eyes in a blur, and then suddenly the ride came to an end, a dead end. He was in a room, again, the tattoo parlor of his garage. The walls dripped red and wet, the neurons freshly burned with the imprint of his most recent memory. The images were technicolor sharp and surreal. It was almost as if time had skipped back a beat, and he was visiting himself moments before he had entered his own brain. Thank you.
No.
Throwing star.
So he's back a moment before all of what you just heard. He slowly drew the ink gun across Cooley's bicep, inking in the last piece of a panoramic collage of his best flash pictures, the drawings and sketches on display in the tattoo parlor that a client could choose from. An eagle with widespread wings squawked an angry battle cry from Cooley's arm, its wings engulfing skulls and snakes in a poker hand full of sinister black aces of spades. All the usual flash combined into one image and more. Kilpatrick had etched a gaping bullet hole in the eagle's white scalp, and blood and chunks of bone sprayed into the backdrop of a windswept and burning American flag. Kilpatrick began to ink in the hand holding the gun pointed at the eagle when Cooley finally took notice.
What the fuck is that?
He shouted, pulling back from the needle, scraping a long black line in the process down his forearm.
What the hell are you doing?
Kilpatrick leaned back smugly and grinned.
You said you wanted a realistic tattoo. Well, that's what you're getting.
Cooley's eyes were black circles of disbelief.
Bullshit! I didn't pay for you to trash all the stuff you just drew on my arm. I don't want the shit covered up now.
You can't cover up the truth. It's reality. It's hell. It's my life and yours. It's America. The world. It's permanent. No sense avoiding it.
Metallic blur, and then the switchblade was pressed against his jugular.
You want reality?
Cooley pressed the cold steel sharply against his neck, and Kilpatrick could feel his pulse beating against the blade.
This is reality, motherfucker!
He suddenly felt calm, as if slipping into a sleepy daydream.
So you understand what I mean, he replied,
enjoying the coolness of the blade against his throat. Cooley's eyes were spinning in circles.
You one sick bastard, man! I'm walking out of here! You ain't gonna stop me! Here!
Cooley threw Kilpatrick back with his elbows and nicked his ear with a knife. Then he found Kilpatrick's cigar box and withdrew a fistful of cash.
I ain't paying for this garbage work you did on me, but you're gonna pay to have it covered up.
And I better not see you again,
understand?
Cooley backed towards the garage door as if expecting Kilpatrick to pull a gun. The artist just crossed his arms like a tattooed shield.
You never saw me at all. You blind, Cooley. Blind.
Then Cooley was gone, slipping out the door and hopping on his cycle. A kickstart, and then he was fleeing down the street. Amid the fading sound of a groaning motor, Kilpatrick thought he could hear Cooley's laughter.
No one fucking understands art anymore, he thought.
And then, back in his mind, he turned from the scene, now sad instead of angry. Cooley had stolen from him, not just his money, but his latest masterpiece. He pickpocketed his talent for his own purposes, like everyone else. Never again. He walked with head hung low, watching his naked feet spatter on the floor of his brain like walking through hot puddles on the street. He could sense the scenes of his past life roaring around him as he walked aimlessly through the corridors of his cranium. Cooley and all that and all the others had stolen from him, taken his life. He felt dead. Now, I am dead, he thought. Maybe Cooley did cut my throat and just leave me to bleed to death or something. That would explain why my life just flashed before my eyes. That's what they say happens to you when you bite it. You relive the past, and then you go to judgment. He raised his head and looked vacantly around, wondering when judgment would come. And then the floor opened up beneath him. Darkness, not blackness, but an absence of all color, grasped him, pulled him down, surrounded him as he fell in the hellish abyss. It sphinctered behind him, and he could feel its undulating faint fibers gripping him, tongues of flame dancing across his naked flesh. He was swallowing darkness. It was filling his nostrils, and again he was choking, but this time he could not cry out. He could not think. He could not feel. The darkness was taking him, eating him, inside out. And then he was in another room. No, not a room, but a cavern with slick pink walls. It was the brightest, hottest room he had seen so far, the walls glistening like the guts of slugs, throbbing like the inside of a beating heart. And then he saw flash. Placed with the geometric perfection of an art gallery were seven framed portraits, each embedded firmly into the pink and wet walls of his brain like square scabs. Seven dark, revolting images, seven shadowy memories, each trapped in a capsule of time by ink. He approached one, and its shadowy dark color became more defined as he came nearer. It was his father, trapped in a moment like a statuesque pose, towering above him in still life with a ratchet gripped in the hairy palm he held over his head, ready to swing. Kilpatrick immediately fell back, wrenching his head from the powerful image. He curled up like a fetus on the fiery floor of the cavern, spilling tears from his eyes.
This must be hell. I must have died and gone to hell.
Through blurry and burning eyeballs, he looked up from the floor, avoiding the portraits. There was no roof or ceiling, just the darkness that had engulfed him. There was no way out. He was trapped, imprisoned. So he returned to his tears, enjoying their soothing wetness. He did so for what seemed like hours, waiting for judgment in lonely isolation. Waiting for the punishment he knew was bound to arrive. He thought perhaps isolation itself was his punishment. Hell is a place of loneliness. Hell is not being able to do what you want, not having freedom to express yourself. Hell is done to you, not by you. Hell is limitations, life's freedoms frozen in ice, or life trapped within time, like the images caged on the walls in this gallery he was trapped in. He cried. He cried until he noticed the tattoo machine in the corner, plugged into the wet walls of the gallery, with a serpentine cord reminiscent of the umbilicus that jutted from his torso. We'll stop there. It goes on. That's... I hope that's bizarro enough. I don't know. But that gives you a taste of grave markings. Craziness of the main character, and maybe the surrealism of it, I don't know what you call it,
To me, it just sounds heavy-handed because it's 20 years old. But it was fun. It's a fun book. Those of you who pick up a copy, thank you. Hope you enjoyed it and let me know what you think of it. Are you ready for the Gregorian chant?
Yeah, there we go.
I want to do this because I'm recording you. This is a short piece from my book, 100 Jolts. It's only a paragraph long. Hopefully it won't drag on forever. It's called The Seven-Headed Beast, and you need a little coaching here, okay? I'm going to ask you all to chant the phrase, "The beast has seven heads and seven sets of teeth." Can you remember that? The beast has seven heads and seven sets of teeth. I just asked if you remembered it, but you're freaking me out. Okay, so I will signal you when I want you all to chant that, okay? Let's do this. The seven-headed beast.
The beast has seven heads and seven sets of teeth.
The first head has no eyes, but sees through its nose. It can conjure a semblance of shape through scent, so it knows just where to bite.
The beast has seven heads and seven sets of teeth.
The second head has 20 necks, a mesh of fleshy tubes cabling up to the brain. All lead back to its heart. Some think this makes it easier to kill, but they die mistaken, for each neck can dodge a blade like a cobra.
The beast has seven heads and seven sets of teeth.
The third head is a small red swab of gummy flesh, no bigger than a pink marshmallow. It absorbs whatever it touches and chews with a manic urgency from somewhere deep inside its pillow of raw tissue.
The beast has seven heads and seven sets of teeth.
The fourth head is long dead and flaccid on the stalk of its purple neck, but its eyes still live and stare and will drive a man mad if he makes contact.
The beast has seven heads and seven sets of teeth.
The fifth head is a death-dry skeleton skull that's puppeteered by a jaundiced wet hand that reaches through its vacant neck hole and throws a demonic voice.
The beast has seven heads and seven sets of teeth.
The sixth head is a beautiful Medusa, whose flesh is a patchwork of scales, whose phallic skeletal asps slither into her sockets and out from her lilac lips, and sometimes they have to fight their way out of the knots they create on her scalp, shedding their skin in the struggle.
The beast has seven heads and seven sets of teeth.
The seventh head is mine, which contains and releases them all. My head hinges and falls backward at the jawline, and then all of them wrestle for attention. They think they control me, but forget that I could chomp right down at just the right time and kill us all.
The beast has seven heads and seven sets of teeth.
Thank you. Live.